we do need to focus much more on prevention rather than treatment and cure, although that has to be sort of combined together.
Welcome to Forever Young, the health and well-being podcast from Lanzerhof. My name is Mario Pedizzoli, and in every episode, join me in conversation with a variety of health experts and special guests as we explore what it means to live well. We may not find the secret to eternal youth, but join me on our quest as we explore just what it means to live a balanced, healthy, and happy life. Hello again and welcome. In today's podcast, we will take a closer look at our eyes and our eye health, in particular the steps we can take to protect the eye and, as far as possible, prevent damage and limit deterioration. The eye itself is truly an incredible organ, and the eye working with the brain to produce 3D vision is nothing short of a miracle that maybe we occasionally take for granted. And as technology evolves, what impact does increasing screen time have on our eyes? The pandemic and working from home has simply increased our reliance on all our devices, with Zoom calls and nearsighted work all, it seems, here to stay. Well, to help us explore the topic and help us all optimize our eye health is Dr. Rachna Murthy. Rachna is a consultant ophthalmologist, oculoplastic and periocular reconstructive surgeon, and is recognized internationally as a key opinion leader in the fields of aesthetics, periocular cancer and thyroid eye disease, and who, I'm delighted to say, has recently joined us with a weekly clinic here at Lanzerhof at the Arts Club. Rachna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mario. It's a real pleasure to be here, and well done on that tongue tie. It's not easy to say yes. Ophthalmologist and oculoplastic, but you got it spot on.
Thanks.
So, one take.
One take.
Thank goodness for that. Look, you're an internationally recognized in the field of oculoplastic surgery. What led you into this field of medicine?
Yeah, I think that our eye area is incredibly important. And I have to say that because I'm incredibly biased and that's what I've specialized in. But we know this from the 60s. When there were gaze tracking studies that were performed by a Russian scientist called Yarbus. And so basically what he did is he had some people and he tracked their gaze and how they communicated with others. And what we see is that our eyes, when we look at somebody, we look at the face, but we scan between eye to eye. We look at the nose, the mouth, and then we look at the rest of the face very briefly. If there's a scar or something else that's noticeable, then we will look at that fleetingly and then land back on the eyes. And so that area is critically important for everything. It's important for communication. It's important for being able to express emotions. It's important to see. So whatever we do with our eyes is hugely important, because we may lose that ability to communicate, we may change our expressed emotion. So even though we are feeling happy, we can look sad to others. And that is something that is not a problem with any other part of the body. Well, sometimes the mouth can look a bit sad, but generally the eye is the area that we all focus on when we communicate. And so I became fascinated with eyes very early on when I was in school. I was very interested in art, also interested in science. There's this dilemma, and you know, what am I going to do? Science, art, science, art. Science prevailed, but I did a lot of drawing and studying of the eye area to the point that I prepared the school final year magazine cover, which was an eye. And that led to really why I went into ophthalmics. I was very interested in the medical side of it, but also using my hands as a skill, as a tool to be able to do the surgery. And with eye care, we have medical interventions, we have surgical interventions, we have prevention, and it's a very much a holistic approach when we are looking after eyes. And that's something that fits in really well with the ethos here at the Lanzerhof.
Yes.
And really, it was serendipity that we came across the Lanzerhof and the concept and well-being. That's, I think, for well-being, the eyes are critical.
Yes, and certainly that is the case. You're very aligned with what we do here at Lanzhof at the Arts Club. You mentioned eye contact and the importance of interpretation, and I suppose the eyes generally tell a story. And during the pandemic, with masks having to be worn, that's maybe only been heightened, hasn't it?
The absolutely. I mean, eye contact has always been there, but that is the area that we have all been focused on for several reasons. And I mean, we're also more focused on it in terms of the changes that have happened and impacted on our eyes in the last couple of years. And certainly in the pandemic time, we've all been very much working at home, using devices and increasing strain around the eyes. For the first time, women and men have been looking back at their faces when they probably hadn't before, for out of vanity, hadn't looked at their faces before. But we've had to stare at our faces, and we've had to stare at our eyes, and we've had to use the computers, screens, and all this technology all the time. And so that's impacted on the eye area significantly in terms of aging and in terms of some of the changes that people are aware of in terms of dry eye disease and lots of other issues with the eyes. And that's where the holistic approach comes into eye care. And with the Lanzerhof, the concept of wellness starts with prevention. And it's a bit of a cliche that the eyes are the windows to the soul, and they do tell a story, but it's also we have the ability to look at the inside workings of the body by looking at someone's eyes, by examining someone's eyes. We can see the blood vessels inside the body. We can see if there are any changes in the blood vessels that might be happening due to certain diseases. We can pick up health issues very, very early on by screening. And I think we do need to focus much more on prevention rather than treatment and cure, although that has to be sort of combined together. And joining the Lanzerhof group here, we work as a multidisciplinary team. The focus is all about wellness and prevention. And by not just focusing on the eye area, so most surgeons will have a hammer. That's a metaphor. Most, I don't have a hammer. But the area that they operate on is like a nail for them. So if you have just a hammer, you will treat everything as a nail and you'll hammer it in. But if the wall that you're hammering this painting into is cracked, then the painting's not going to stay up. And that basically what I mean by that is that you have to approach a person, you have to approach someone's eyes by looking at the whole body.
Yes.
And similarly, the eyes can tell the story about what's going on in the whole body.
Yes.
And working in the team here, we can help with picking up heart disease, diabetes, cancers, lots of things that we wouldn't know about until much later on, unless you had body scans or other things, which we do have the ability to do as well here.
Yes.
So when we can pick up early signs of disease, then that can also then be actioned, and we can organize imaging and treatment. And that is medical treatment as well as psychological support. A lot of the things that we will perhaps talk about in a moment is the aesthetic impact of the eye area and how functional changes cross over with aesthetics because of the expressed emotion changes that can happen when the aesthetic changes.
Well, let's certainly have a look at that. But absolutely the case that we take a whole body approach to someone's well-being here, and that's why this has dovetailed so very well. But how does the eye area, in fact, impact people's self-esteem and their sense of well-being? What are sort of typical cases that you see?
Yeah, so a lot of the functional work that I specialize in particular is relating to eye disease that is due to other systemic conditions. Mm. So skin cancer, for instance, or an autoimmune disease called Graves' disease, which is an overactive thyroid, that can cause patients to have bulgy eyes. Mm. It's not an uncommon condition. So about 30% of the population will have Graves' disease. About 5% of the Graves' disease patients can develop thyroid-related eye disease. Mm. And people are still going blind with this condition. But interestingly, and I led the service in the UK regionally in the Cambridge area for the last sort of 13 years and have presented internationally on this, the main thing that impacts my patients and the vast majority of people who suffer from this are those that are at the peak of their career, mm. who are theoretically very fit and healthy, but perhaps under sort of a lot of stress with their work. The main thing that they are bothered about is the impact on the aesthetics of the eye area. So not the fact that they may well be getting a little bit of red eye or double vision or maybe losing their vision, but the fact that their eyes are bulgy, they can't then go out of the house. They don't feel comfortable to have photographs taken. It impacts on their relationships, impacts on their work, their career. It has a huge impact on the quality of life. And so very much functional change in the eye area can affect the aesthetic, and that can affect quality of life. Mm. And so when we approach a patient with skin cancer, so skin cancers, for instance, yes, it's a functional condition, mm. and we want to get rid of the cancer. But I'm operating on someone's face, and I'm operating on the most critical part of someone's face. And if I leave my signature as a scar on their face, one, they're not going to thank me, but that is the thing that everybody else is going to focus on when yes. they look at that person's face. Yes. They're not also going to want to have photographs taken. So it has to be invisible surgery, and that is the kind of surgery I specialize in, so skin cancer reconstruction. And it has to be aesthetic. So a functional treatment has to also be aesthetic.
Yes.
Because it will change the expression. It will impact on how other people perceive that person.
And that's the balance you have to strike
every
time.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
And so let's talk about that, because in that example, health versus aesthetics, it sounds like aesthetics usually prompts an inquiry more so than the health-related issue if people are struggling with their self-esteem, with their looks, and so on.
Yeah.
But you have to strike that balance. And sometimes they overlap, as in the case you've just described, but sometimes they conflict. How do you manage this with the patient, and are there any examples that you can give us?
Yeah, so I think that the conflict between aesthetics and function is something that is much more here in the UK than perhaps elsewhere, for instance, in the US or in countries like Brazil. And some parts of Europe, so France perhaps, it's much more acceptable to have to see somebody for an aesthetic treatment. Mm-hmm. There is no taboo, whether you're a male or a female, there is less of a taboo or no taboo in some countries. Here in the UK, it's very much thought of that an aesthetic treatment is something that is only for people who are actors, actresses, or it's not something that's as acceptable. Mm. People aren't as open with having any aesthetic work done.
Do you think that's changing?
Absolutely, I think it's changing. I think that the social media and a lot of the literature that's coming out is making it much more acceptable for people to talk about what they've had done. I mean, there's been recent articles in newspapers, for instance, where Marc Jacobs has talked about the plastic surgery he's had. Mm. High-profile doctors have talked about the work that they've had. And it's becoming much more acceptable to talk about it, first of all, but also people are recognizing the impact on quality of life with the aesthetic changes. And so it's less of a aesthetic treatment that people are having done, and it's becoming more of the realms of medical treatment. I'm going to bring in something here, which is called neuromodulation. So neuromodulation is things like toxins, Botox, for instance. Mm-hmm. That is something that is still a big taboo in terms of having treatments done. But actually, neuromodulation first came out of ophthalmology. So it was developed in patients who were having treatments for an inturning eye or a squint or an outturning eye. And this medication was developed, Botox was developed to treat and weaken the muscle so that it corrected a functional condition. It was also used for something called blepharospasm, where the eyes go into spasm, and a lot of people do suffer from that. And it's a big medical market for treating spasms around the eyes. These patients found that their wrinkles got better, and then of course that spawned the whole cosmetic industry in terms of having neuromodulation for lines and wrinkles. But it started off as a functional condition that was being treated for a functional treatment. And Botox has, and toxin has been used for many other medical conditions, and it's used for migraines, it's used for hyperhidrosis, which is excessive sweating. There are lots of new indications for treating scars. So it's not just an aesthetic thing. And I think that's where the boundaries are now blurring and it's becoming more acceptable to have aesthetic, inverted commas, treatments.
And all the more reason for the industry to maybe be more regulated than it is currently, would you say?
It's a difficult situation. In Europe, we are probably the only country where you can not have a medical degree and you can order something like a filler product over the internet and inject it into somebody. And so it is not regulated at all.
Sounds frightening. It's the Wild West out there.
It is a Wild West out here. It definitely is a Wild West out here. In other countries, you have to be a doctor. In some countries, you have to be a surgeon or a particular type of surgeon or a particular type of dermatologist to do these treatments. But fillers are medical devices, so they come under a different category from neuromodulation, which is a drug. So you have to be a doctor in this country to prescribe neuromodulation, and you can prescribe for somebody else who can give the neuromodulation, who can be a nurse or a dentist, but anybody can pick up a filler and inject. Fortunately, the risks with these are rare and low, and it's something that is manageable. And globally, there are over 8 million fillers being injected every year. So it's a huge market, and it's going to increase because we can do so much, and it's not just an aesthetic treatment. So just like with neuromodulation, I use fillers to treat patients with facial palsy who can't have surgery. Some of my thyroid patients with active thyroid eye disease who can't close their eyes properly because their eyes are so bulgy, I have to manage them medically to reduce the inflammation with drugs such as immunosuppressive drugs and steroids. But at the same time, I can't operate on them to close their eyes, to help them close their eyes, because it can aggravate the disease. But using something like a filler can help them to close their eyes and be much more comfortable. And so the boundaries there in terms of the aesthetic products also cross over with something that could be used for a medical treatment. So yes, there's a conflict definitely for people coming in to have an aesthetic treatment, but it's becoming much more acceptable, and certainly becoming much more acceptable to men when it never was beforehand. They have changes much earlier in the eye area. So you unfortunately will have a lowering of your brows much more early than I will, because females naturally have eyebrows that start off above their brow socket bone or eye socket bone, and so that's called the orbit. But you would have started off with your eyebrows much flatter and below the bone. And so we all age similarly, in that we lose collagen, and with gravity, everything drops. But your brows will unfortunately start to lower, and the skin of the lids will encroach upon the lashes, and that will impact on the field of vision. And that happens earlier in men than it does in women. And particularly over the last year, staring at faces, working from home, staring at their faces on the Zoom calls, more men have noticed that. And it's becoming much more acceptable to have something done at an earlier stage, because everybody wants to feel better.
Sure,
everybody,
sure.
You know, not just look better, but feel better. And you know, this is something that is acceptable.
Well, that kind of brings me to the next question, which is, you know, of course, via Zoom and other media, we've been talking digitally for a year and a half now to each other, and therefore hence the added focus on our eyes and, and how we look generally. But let's look at technology, and by that I mean smartphones, tablets, laptops, etc. And it seems we're in front of screens, you know, all day, every day these days. And and for the younger generation and our children, you know, they're starting and will start even earlier in life. We celebrate how technology's transformed our lives for the better, but has this been at the expense of our eye health?
I would say yes. Now, the scientific evidence suggests that there is no permanent damage from staring at the VDU, staring at our screens and staring at our telephones. But we all know when, you know, from personal experience, that when you stare at a computer for long enough or you stare at your phone for long enough, your eyes start to feel uncomfortable. There's a lot more eye strain. And I don't think that the science has picked up the damage just yet. What we do know is that the eyes become much drier. The blue light exposure increases the bacterial load around the eyes. We don't blink as much as we should do. And so that also dries our eyes out even more. But in terms of radiation, I don't think the cumulative exposure is going to be able to compete against staring at the sun, for instance. Right. So you have to balance the risks and benefits. Yes, children are using screens much more, and that younger generation is going to be much more exposed to...
Actually, you just mentioned we don't blink as much as we used to. What's happening there?
Not about blinking as much as we used to, but when we are focusing on a screen, we want to see. And
so that's when we blink less.
And as we get older, we also blink less because we're straining to see. And so if you're trying to look at a screen share, for instance, you're looking at the small print on the shared screen, or you're looking at whatever's being presented, you're trying to focus and to see what you're looking at. And so you will not blink as much. And the blink is basically, it's like the wipers on a windshield of a car. So you have the tear gland that produces tears, and then just like on a windscreen, when you're cleaning a windscreen, the wipers will wipe that washer all over the screen and clear the screen. But if you're not blinking, so your wipers are not working as frequently, then you're going to dry the surface of your clear windows of your eyes, and you're going to get blurred vision, you're going to get eye strain, you're going to get dryness. And all of that does impact on our eye health. So yes, I do think that we will find that there is some permanent damage. It's just that the science hasn't been able to pick that up. And we're getting more cumulative exposure to blue light and mobile phones than we ever used to.
Ah, well, actually, yes. Could you maybe help us understand and define blue light, and how can we limit it or I don't think we can eliminate it from our lives.
No, I mean, blue light forms part of the magnetic spectrum with electromagnetic spectrum. So visible light forms one part of that. And at one end of the spectrum, you have the blues, and the other end, you have the reds. So you have infrared and you have ultraviolet. And sunlight is just one part of visible light, but we get the whole electromagnetic spectrum that we're exposed to when we're just walking outdoors. Similarly, from the screen, we have much more blue coming through. And technology is changing to try and reduce the blue light exposure. So a lot of the mobile phones that we have these days will have a night mode, or they'll have an ability to reduce the brightness and alter the amount of blue coming out. There are blue light reduction glasses, which, again, anecdotally, people find that they do have less eye strain. They sleep better when they use it.
Do you recommend those, prescribe those?
I don't prescribe those. I don't necessarily recommend those, but I know that there are lots of people who use them and have found benefit from it. But the scientists have not said that it is of any benefit, and it's not been shown to have any benefit. Right. But people do sleep better and they have less eye strain. So I think it's a good thing.
Mm. And what else can we do to improve our eye health generally? Nutrition certainly plays a part. What advice do you have?
Yeah, so this sort of comes into a huge sort of buzz topic, which is the microbiome. Microbiome is basically the organisms that we all carry. So we have a world that is our skin, our gut, and their little countries within our body, which are populated by lots of colonies of microorganisms that could be bacteria and viruses. Now, this sounds awful because it's, you know, am I saying we're carrying lots of bugs? But, you know, we are carrying lots of good bugs. Mm-hmm. And those good bugs are protecting us. They're protecting our barriers. So our gut is one major barrier for nasty bugs coming through. Mm-hmm. Our skin is another major barrier for bugs coming through. Our eye surface is a barrier. Our mouth, our nose, they're all inlets, entry points for nasty things, but we have healthy colonies of bacteria and viruses that sit on all those barriers. And one of the things that we can do to improve our eye health in particular is to look after the microbiome around our eyelids, our skin. And to that end, I have worked with a company called Clinical Health Technologies that is an award-winning company. They manufacture something called hypochlorous acid, and I'll tell you about that. Yes. Because hypochlorous acid is something that has been known about for over 100 years, even before iodine and chlorhexidine came into use in terms of antiseptic treatments. Mm. It's actually what our white blood cells, which are the blood cells in our bloodstream, produce to destroy invading organisms. So when that barrier function is broken down and bugs get into our body, our white blood cells are recruited to produce this hypochlorous acid, which they release and destroys the bacteria. And we've harnessed that science, the company that makes hypochlorous acid, to a very pure level. There's no alcohol in it. It is able to effectively cleanse and be antimicrobial, so it can destroy bacteria and viruses and protect the microbiome, so it resets the microbiome. I've worked with this company for the last 3 years to produce something that is safe for eye use, so it's the same pH as the eye surface, and we produce something called Purifies, and that is something that we use after all our surgery for our patients to use around the periocular area after all of the treatments that we do, so the toxins and injectable treatments, and it reduces the risk of infection. Mm-hmm. It protects the microbiome, but it's also a huge benefit to prevention of dry eye disease, so particularly with VDU use. And
so not just post-surgery?
Not just post-surgery. It's of benefit for anybody who uses a gym, anybody who's flying in an aeroplane, anybody who has to wear a mask for extended time, because we're blowing bacteria all over our eyes when we're wearing masks with the air leaks. And that, you know, I'm sure you've noticed, I've certainly noticed from wearing masks a lot of the time for the last year, that my eyes have felt much more uncomfortable because I'm blowing bacteria all over my eyes.
Actually, I feel sorry for people that wear glasses too.
That's even worse. That's because you missed up. And I had that issue initially with wearing loops when I operate, and that creates an even greater sort of bacterial colony. But this is something that can help to reset that microbiome and prevent future dry eye disease. And that actually is a huge burden. That was a very noisy motorbike that went past. I think they were interested in that topic. But it's about 80% of us will have some level of dry eye disease during our life, and it's worse as we get older. And it is caused by all the things that we do. You'll have exposure to pollutants, you'll have exposure to the BDUs, we'll have certain types of makeup that women wear that have a lot of toxins in it that we're not aware of. Formaldehyde was still being used in mascara and eye makeup and hair shampoo, and there are a lot of products that still, sort of high level products that still contain toxins like formaldehyde.
Yes.
And we're using that on our eye surface. And so that creates this later dry eye disease, and it destroys the microbiome around the eyelids.
So your purifier's range helps address this?
So purifiers, the product itself for the eyes, is helps to address that. And it's possibly the missing step in skincare and eye care, because it protects the microbiome. We're doing a lot in terms of probiotics and supplements, as you said, to improve our health. And this is a way of, rather than having a bacteria that you put on your eyelids and eyes, although that might be a future way, we're resetting that microbiome and improving the barrier function and protection to reduce the risk of later on dry eye disease.
I should say, for more information on, if you're enjoying this topic and are interested in either an appointment with Rachna or the products themselves, please email lanzerhoff@theartsclub.co.uk. Coming back to the talk, are people becoming more aware of the need for eye health? I think you've said yes, they are. But what are the risk factors for diseases of the eye? And in talking about that, how much does hereditary versus lifestyle choices play a part?
Yeah, so there are a lot of lifestyle choices that we make that I think as a nation, as a group, we are becoming more aware of what we do and how that can impact on our health. Our eyes give us the ability for doctors like myself to have a look and screen for health conditions. So blood pressure problems, so hypertension, diabetes can cause changes to the blood vessels. And so we can pick up these changes early on. Hereditary conditions that affect the eyelids, like a droopy eyelid, can be picked up on very early on. And it's really important for something like that to be picked up early, because until a child is 8, you can improve the vision and reduce the risk of a lazy eye, a permanent lazy eye, by improving the position of the eyelid. A slightly droopy eyelid may be affecting the eye prescription, the ability to see. And so addressing that early on can improve future eyesight. So yes, we're able to pick up lots of diseases and things that will impact on future health at an early stage by screening and looking at the back of the eye.
So we clearly have a personal responsibility for our own health, never mind just eye health, but for the parents amongst us, we also have a responsibility towards our children's eye health as well. And again, we are increasingly worried about technology and you know, everything we spoke about earlier about screen time. Well, it applies as much, if not more, to our children. If we left them to their own devices, they'd be on their devices all day. And so how can we be more mindful of that? And what advice can you give for responsible parenting here?
Good question. So as a trying to be responsible parent myself, you have to balance the risks and the benefits. I think there are great things to be said about technology. And this generation of children are much more comfortable using technology. some gaming devices improve hand-eye coordination. They always used to say that as an eye surgeon, if you'd spent your youth playing computer games with a joystick, that improved your hand-eye coordination. Fortunately for me, I actually spent a lot of time playing computer games with a joystick, so my hand-eye coordination is not too bad. So there are advantages to technology, but that has to be balanced with the detrimental effects. And so how can we be responsible? Talking about technology itself, we can limit the time. We can limit the exposure to the blue light. We can also ensure that children have good lighting in the background when they're looking at the screens, so they're not straining. And that there is a healthy balance as well, so that they're encouraged to be outdoors and enjoy outdoor pursuits as well, and things that are generally good for well-being, communicating with their friends on a personal basis, not just through a computer. Because I think, you know, there is a risk that they will get used to communicating just by typing or on a phone or on a computer game. And that depersonalizes the whole friendship element to it, and communication element. But talking about being outside, it's far more risky to send your child outside without sunglasses and a hat.
Sure.
So you can't win. So yeah, to limit the technology, but also, you know, protect from other things that you have to consider as well. So pollutants and sunlight. So talking about sunlight, you know, sunglasses. You want to have something that's broad spectrum, so UVA and UVB, that covers the spectrum of the electromagnetic spectrum we talked about beforehand.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be incredibly expensive, but it has to just cover that. And then you are protecting your child's eyes. In terms of skin cancer, which is another interest, as I've already said, the eyelid area is the most prone to damage. It's the thinnest skin in the body, so less than half a millimeter in some areas.
Yes.
And that's why it ages first. So you see the aging changes first. It's a very mobile area with all the muscles underneath that help us express. But it's also an area that is usually not addressed in terms of protection. This is a podcast, so I can't show you the pictures, but there's been an amazing photograph that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they showed this truck driver who has spent years driving his truck in the US being exposed to sunlight on one side and not on the other. And one side is covered in lines and wrinkles and with an aged sort of eye area and all the other things that can happen in terms of eye and sunlight. So growths on the eye surface, cataracts, damage to the back of the eye, with macular degeneration, with macula being the area of the eye in the retina that focuses when we look at something and read something. The other side was much more youthful, with very few lines and wrinkles, and a much more healthy side. So the sunlight is probably far worse an enemy in terms of sun aging and cancer, and skin aging and cancer, than VDUs.
I'm trying to imagine what he must look like.
I'll show you the picture.
Yes, fascinating and frightening.
But you can look it up if you Google it. Yeah, it's the New England Journal of Medicine and truck driver with sun aging.
And let's talk about the positive aspects of technology and with medical advances today. What does the future look like for eye health, for both prevention and cure?
So in ophthalmology, we use a lot of technology. We are able to objectively, in the Lanzerhof, we're able to objectively record our eye health. We're able to take photographs in 3D imaging of the facial structures and the eyelid area. We're able to image the back of the eye.
Yes, I've been a victim of that.
No, it was. I think quite a good experience for you. I think so, it's not always a good experience to see your photograph, let alone see your photograph in three dimension. But it's a good thing to do because you see what other people see, which is a positive thing. It should be taken as a positive thing rather than a negative thing. But technology allows us to look at the thickness of the back of the eye, the thickness of the front of the eye, to see whether there are changes due to damage from something called glaucoma, which is something we also check for and screen for here. Mm-hmm. Glaucoma is a condition that is fairly indolent. Open-angle glaucoma can blind, and that is raised pressure in the eye that damages the nerve at the back of the eye. So we can check for pressure. We can check to see whether the thickness of the front of the eye is impacting on the pressure. And we can treat with drops. So there are lots of other treatments as well. But technology is hugely important in the ability for us to be able to deliver the optimal service in terms of prevention, as well as objectively recording, and in terms of our treatments and how that improves the things that we're assessing.
And we mentioned this, you know, you now have your weekly clinic here at Lanzarote at the Arts Club. What plans do you have, and maybe describe the range of services that you will be offering here?
Yeah, so our services, and I work jointly with my business partner, Jonathan Roos, who is also an oculoplastic surgeon and ophthalmologist. We uniquely work together, I think, in providing a diverse team. So we have the male-female perspective. Mm. We're providing two consultant experts who will give the second opinion, built-in second opinion, but also we're able to listen and spend more time listening. And that is a problem with many medical professionals, that they don't actually listen to their patient. Mm. We're able to offer a listening ear, as well as inquiring mind, as well as being able to offer the assessments. But you asked what sort of services we provide. So we provide the whole hog when it comes to eye care. So it's not purely eyes. Mm. We examine the eyes fully, and so we're able to screen for all the conditions that we talked about. And so we provide a service called Verifies, which is basically a lot of our programs have the tag name eyes at the end of it. So you'll know it includes eye care in everything that we do. Mm. And that is the pivot of everything that we do, essentially, that all our treatments can impact the eyes. So we address the eyes as well. And we do 3D imaging of the face and are able to help with improving the structure of the face non-surgically with injectables and the periocular area. And we're also able to provide surgical intervention if needed. So as oculoplastic surgeons specializing in that eye area, the most critical area, as we've talked about, we're able to restore aging changes or treat functional problems. Mm-hmm. And work as a team with the rest of the Lanzerhof specialists, who are incredibly good at what they do. So we have the psychological support from our general practitioner here, Dr. Irvine. We have imaging capabilities, and we're going to be offering, in terms of COVID, a lot of people are suffering from long COVID, which is the aftermaths of infection a long time ago, a lot of headache issues. With any headache, we have to exclude raised pressure in the brain. Mm-hmm. And we can look at the back of the eye and exclude that. Mm-hmm. So that is part of the team approach, that, you know, if somebody is having headaches, that's seeing Dr. Irvine, for instance, and Levine, sorry, coming, then she won't like me saying that, but I'm glad I corrected myself. Sorry, Dr. Levine. Sorry, Ursula. So anyway, if she comes across somebody who is seeing her with a headache, then we are able to provide support for that and investigate and address that. And that support is extended to anybody who has long COVID symptoms. And it's just general wellness. That's what we're all about. We're about wellness, not just aesthetics, not just eye care. It's the whole body and treating the person as a person.
Rashna, it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
No, it's a pleasure for me as well. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And it's wonderful having you here amongst us at Lanzerhof at the Arts Club. Should any of today's talk be of interest and you have any inquiry to make, please email lanzerhof@theartsclub.co.uk. Rachna, again, thank you very much and see you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.